People of America, listen. Is monopoly still an economic problem? Here is the 311th Wake Up America quiz debate featuring Dr. J. Raymond Walsh, economist, lecturer, and radio commentator, and Dr. Alfred P. Hockey, industrial consultant, economist, and lecturer. As usual, the program is spontaneous and unrehearsed. This discussion between Dr. Alfred P. Hockey and Dr. J. Raymond Walsh is presented under the auspices of the American Economic Foundation. Now here's your Wake Up America moderator, Mr. Hamilton Ames. Mr. Ames.
Thank you, Don Gardner. A long time ago, a philosopher remarked that words were invented to conceal thought. That particular philosopher may have been cleverer than he was right. But it is certainly true that rarely do we find common agreement on the limitation of the terms ordinarily used in the analysis and interpretation of our material welfare. The word monopoly is a case in point. And if we're to debate constructively the question, is monopoly an economic problem, we can hardly do so unless we try to avoid the pitfalls of linguistic confusion by starting at the simplest beginning. Dr. Hockey, will you then start us off by supplying a good layman's definition of monopoly?
Mr. Ames, before we define monopoly, we must correct a widespread confusion in many minds. Big business and monopoly are not the same thing. The mere fact of bigness does not mean monopoly. Indeed, it is thanks to bigness, together with competition, that we owe our marvelous industrial position and high standard of living today. The word monopoly means one seller. Therefore, there must be control of supply. And that control must be strong enough to fix prices independently of competition. So monopoly becomes a condition that exists when we have only one seller, or when there is such complete control over the supply that the sellers can fix the price of the article without regard for competition. Monopoly is the opposite of competition.
Dr. Walsh.
Well, I think Mr. Hockey sort of excludes all of the discussion this afternoon by that kind of a definition, because pure monopoly is pretty hard to find. The Aluminum Company of America was a monopoly, I suppose. The United States Post Office, a public monopoly. Pure competition, on the other hand, or perfect competition, is pretty hard to find, too. What's interesting is that most production and commercial activity is carried on within the area between these two extremes, what the books are now calling monopolistic competition, which I'd define as a situation where competition in the industry is not greatly to be feared. And hence, I'd get directly to this comment that Dr. Hockey made about big business not being the same as monopoly. Big business makes it difficult for newcomers to get into an industry, and therefore produces in a situation elements of monopoly. And that's the interesting problem.
Big business also makes it possible for small business to come into the picture. Sometimes big business requires a service of small business and actually creates small business. I don't want to rule out all monopoly, but I think we should rule out monopolies that do not deserve discussing. For example, there are such monopolies, government monopolies, as the post office. We're not going to discuss that. There are such monopolies that are sometimes called the natural monopolies, the utilities, which come under government license and control. They are more efficient than competition. I don't think we should discuss them. That leaves all the other monopolies that ought to come under control, except patents and copyrights, and it's with those that we are concerned.
Yes, but
where the supply is controlled. Now, one doesn't define black as gray. One defines it as black.
Then I take it, Dr. Hockey, you are admitting that the area in between is the interesting area, where there are elements of monopoly, or as the phrase has it, monopolistic competition. Now, when you say a big business frequently calls small business into being, I'm aware that in auto industries they bring supply concerns into existence, but I don't think that any talent I'd have would make it possible for me to start an automobile company. You need $20 million to do it. The very size eliminates any possibility of small enterprise coming in.
And
if
yet that
the
does
big business
not,
doesn't want them to come in.
I see. But that does not, it does not follow from that, does it, Dr. Walsh? That because it's difficult to get into an industry, that it is thereby monopolistic. There can still be very considerable competition.
Yes, because...
And the rights of the public completely protected.
All right. A considerable amount of competition means considerable amounts of something else. And that's just the interesting point. Because I think you and I would both agree that monopolistic elements in an economy are antagonistic to free enterprise. And personally, I'm a great enthusiast about free enterprise. And I view monopoly in all its forms, except those legal forms and necessary ones such as you referred to a moment ago, I view all monopoly as in itself a threat to that kind of free economy which functions in good old competitive terms. And that's gone throughout our economy to a dimension that is dismaying, I think, to all people, including a man like Beardsley Rummel, who says that it seems to be getting into every part of our economic life.
But don't you see, Dr. Walsh, when you get through with your taking exceptions to my definition, you have left no standard by which to judge what is monopoly or is not.
Well, I'll give you a standard if you want.
The standard of monopoly, certainly by the meaning of the word, and the meaning that has developed all through the years, is control of supply, and through control of supply, to be able to fix price.
Yes,
now, there may be varying degrees of control, and there may be varying degrees of power of fixing the price. But those two elements are the monopolistic elements.
That's right. So that where there's a sufficient amount of control of supply that competition isn't feared, there you have a monopolistic situation, either a pure one, which is very infrequent, or a partial one, which is extremely frequent.
I would make one amendment. Instead of saying where a competition is not feared, where competition has no effect.
Well, it wouldn't be feared, of course, if it had no effect.
It might still be feared.
Well, I think we've reached a definition on this.
Might not be feared and still have effect.
Gentlemen, since we've reached, I think, some basis on which we can continue our topic, I'd like to ask Dr. Walsh whether, in your opinion, is the Department of Justice vigorously enforcing present laws against monopoly?
Oh, I'd say by no means at all. You see, before the war, we had a spell there where monopoly and monopolistic competition were pretty serious, and we put Thurman Arnold in the Department of Justice, who had a passion to restore competition. He built up a large staff. They did very effective work. And then suddenly the war brought a moratorium on all this work, and the trust busting ceased. And during the war, the situation has become, I think everybody would agree, worse than it was before. And so far as I can see now, there's very little passion and determination in our Department of Justice in regard to this problem. And the staff that's assigned the task of studying and acting on this problem has not been built up very much from what it was during the drab days of the war. So, and anyway, I personally doubt the possibility of success against monopolies in this way. Anyway, it takes too long, and by the time a judgment in the court is secured, the monopoly will have altered its ways of achieving the same end anyway. It'll just found different means, as history is full of those cases.
I find it rather interesting to remember that Thurman Arnold said there were no monopolies. He said the two concerns that came closest to it, but neither one was a monopoly, were the Aluminum Company and the United Machine Shoe Company, but there were no monopolies. He found some evidence of conspiracies here and there. The real monopoly today is not, therefore, in the ordinary field, because there the laws have operated rather well. Much better than 50 or 60 years ago.
Well, let me give you
a
case.
The real monopoly today, Dr. Walsh, is in the one field where there is complete control of supply, and that is in organized labor.
Yeah, but Dr. Hockey, you keep wanting to define this. You see, that's why I thought your definition was unfortunate. You define it in a way that eliminates discussion. Let me, for example, we may later on discuss the automobile industry, which you know more about than I, but I think that's a monopolistic competitive situation. But let me give another case, an odd case, cheese. My home used to be Wisconsin, and cheese, why everybody thinks cheese, of course, must be competitive. Think of all the farmers who are producing it. And yet up in the little town, Plymouth, Wisconsin, I think it's every Saturday morning, the representatives of four or five companies, Armour, Swift, packing companies, and so on, get together, and they go through an elaborate and very interesting mumbo-jumbo where one bids on the other's cheese and the other bids on the first one's cheese and so on, and then out through the wires goes the comment that the price of Swiss cheese is 15 cents a pound or whatever it may be. It's a complete and utter phony. There's a complete monopolistic or monopolistically competitive situation in which the production is less than it would otherwise be and the price is higher.
Frankly, I don't have ever sat in on those meetings, and I frankly question whether it's right to call it a complete monopoly. On the other hand, Thurman Arnold tried to stop monopoly in the organized labor field. He recognized there was one there, and found that he couldn't do it, and it finally went to the Supreme Court. And it was the Supreme Court of the United States that said in almost so many words that the antitrust laws do not apply to labor organizations, in consequence of which, organized labor is free to do things that business wouldn't dare do. It's immune. There are no legal restraints. And in my judgment, Dr. Ross, that isn't defining the question out of discussion. Frankly, I think that you are more guilty of that than I am, if either one of us is guilty. Because it takes the discussion right into the field of organized labor.
Dr. Hawkins, if you want to talk about really organized labor, I'd be glad to talk about it, but it happens that the question dealt with the work of the Department of Justice in using the Sherman Antitrust Act that doesn't happen to apply to labor unions. So why get, you both narrow the discussion and get out of the field. In the opinion of lots of people, including myself, monopoly exists to some degree in the labor unions, particularly, of course, as Thurman Arnold insisted, in the building trade. But I do not think that any economist, Professor Tausig, for example, at Harvard, would have thought of that as being of significance in terms of the functioning of our economy, to the degree that this ubiquitous and general monopolistic restraint upon competition throughout the economy, everywhere you look, when we get to patents, we'll see that patents are used in innumerable cases to establish some control over supply, put it in your terms.
But, Dr. Walsh, don't you see you are evading the real question?
What is the real question?
The real question is the department enforcing laws against monopoly? And you are,
I said it was,
by defining it, you are saying that it is not doing so because organized labor is not monopoly.
Do you know how many men they have down there doing it?
I don't know how many
Six.
Men, but that doesn't matter.
Well, it certainly
The fact
does.
Is that no effort is being made, and certainly that monopoly is an exceedingly serious one. A handful of men can keep 175,000 men or hundreds of thousands of men out of work. The whole machinery of production stops. Tools are no longer used. Investors lose. The public doesn't get the goods because a few men can absolutely stop production. They control the supply of the labor.
Well, now, Dr. Hockey, as I say, the question here was whether the Department of Justice is enforcing the law. The law doesn't happen to apply to labor unions. I could understand you saying that the law should apply to labor unions, and so far as I'm concerned, I'd be happy to have monopoly within unions where it exists be subject to prosecution by the government. I don't think it's a great phenomenon. I think it's confined almost exclusively to the building trade. And generally speaking, the students of the subject seem to agree on that. Where it exists, I'm against it. I'm against monopoly, even in trade unions.
Well, that's fine. Now, I'll admit that the Department of Justice lifted labor out from under the antitrust laws. But it did not lift labor out from under
the Supreme Court,
I should say. Yes, of course. The Supreme Court lifted them out. It did not lift them out from under the Constitution. It is still the duty of the Department of Justice to enforce the Constitution. To enforce the rights of individuals.
I know
protection of life and property.
I know no...
And a labor union with its pickets can absolutely ignore the law.
This is really peculiar. It isn't in the Constitution. There's nothing in the Constitution to prevent monopoly existing.
There is much in the Constitution that gives a man the right to go to work, to go through the door of his own office. There's in the Constitution protection against physical harm coming to people who do not want to go along with the union. The Constitution is supposed to protect us against having our automobiles turned over when we go about our business down the street,
right,
when pickers don't want us to do it.
Dr. Hockey,
so that whole group of rights is being ignored.
May I remind you, we're discussing monopoly and not violence on the street.
That is a way in which the monopoly is enforced.
Monopoly is
enforced in ways that it could be stopped if the government took it seriously.
Now you're talking about picketing, aren't you?
I'm talking about picketing
all
and
right,
a lot of
now,
other activities.
Picketing...
The point is that the labor union has so much power that it can even control the government. It can even make a Secretary of Commerce take back now a thing that's not true after it has served its purpose. By its votes, it can control the government. It's bad enough to have a monopoly that doesn't come under the antitrust law.
Remember, Dr. Hockey, you define monopoly
when it
as
can control the government.
You defined monopoly as control of supply. Now you've gone blasting out in so many different directions that nobody, I'm sure, can follow you. You're on the picket line. You're talking about violence. You're talking about so many things, you know, that have nothing to do with this question, that I suggest the moderator get us back on the track.
I'd like to...
Dear Dr.
establish this
Walsh,
to this extent.
Getting back
well,
on
Mr.
the track.
Mr. Ames, what's the next question?
Pardon me. That can't quite happen that way. I am discussing the supply of labor, thoroughly so, and the control of the supply of labor when I discuss the things, the means that the union uses to control that supply to make it effective.
Give me a case.
The picketing is a case.
A case
when 175,000 men go out of work, I say there's no competition there. The union has control
of
the supply of labor.
Then
man who wants a job can go to work if
May
he
I
wants
make
to.
It quite
the
plain
union
that
prevents
Dr. Hockey
the competition from supplying the service that the union, that the company wants.
Mr. Ames,
Dr.
Control.
Walsh, please. Dr. Walsh, your reply to that.
Keep Mr. Hockey from exploding here.
I'm not exploding,
Dr. Hockey,
but not at all.
Dr. Hockey is suggesting that the right of strike be removed by law. I'd just like
Pardon
to report.
Me, I've said nothing of the sort. I have said that it ought to be exercised within the law.
He wants it removed by law.
I want it exercised within
now,
the
gentlemen.
Law. And I want the Department of Justice to enforce the law and see to it that John Doakes and Jimmy Smith and George Kaczynski all get the same treatment.
Now, see, as I say, he's against the right of strike, and he wants to eliminate it.
I am for the right of strike.
That should be quite
I am also for the right to work. And I am against anyone sneering at the law and ignoring prohibition against violence.
Dr. Hockey and Dr. Walsh, I'd like to develop this topic just a little farther. Since a few moments ago it seemed to be clear that we had two staunch believers in private enterprise, or free enterprise, I believe Dr. Walsh and Dr. Hockey both use that term, I'd like to ask Dr. Hockey, do you believe that the private ownership of the tools of production has any effect, one way or the other, on the tendency toward monopoly?
Why, I think, Mr. Ames, that the private ownership of tools of production has a distinct tendency away from monopoly. So long as we can retain private property in the tools of production and continue opportunity for individuals to enter business or to invest their money in business ventures conducted by others, we need have little or no fear of monopoly. The greatest danger of monopoly arises from government. Government monopoly is the perfect monopoly, for then to the economic power, we add the police power of the state, the power to control or destroy sellers or buyers. Labor monopoly is dangerous because it is free of legal restraints, but it becomes even more dangerous when it builds a state within a state and threatens to destroy the owners of the tools themselves, uses its enormous vote power to control that state for the benefit of its members. Thus, when you add PAC to CIO, you get the maximum danger to the people, and especially to labor itself, even though the danger be concealed for a time.
Dr. Walsh.
I am so pleased to hear Dr. Hockey express concern about the labor movement. It's so fine that he's a good friend of the labor movement and wants them not to be hurt by PAC. At the same time, as I said a few moments ago, he is interested in taking away their right to strike. Now, on this question, private
I
ownership
beg your
of the
pardon,
tools...
Dr.
Just one moment, Dr.
Hockey.
Mr. Ames,
that.
Can you keep him quiet for
I
a minute?
I'll keep quiet if you confine yourself to the question. I will not permit you to say that I'm opposed to letting men keep the right to strike. It isn't true, and you know it.
I'd like to have Dr. Walsh continue his answer, and then we can
Thank
return
Thank you very much. Question. That's courtesy. Private ownership, of course, clearly is the only way we can avoid monopoly of the state. That's obvious. Public monopoly, by inference, follows if you don't have private ownership of the tools of production. But private ownership as such, beyond this, has nothing to do with the matter at all. The size, or the complexity, or the expense of the tools have. Because the larger they are, the more expensive they are, the more they encourage a monopolistic situation for the very simple reason that the larger and more expensive they are, the more difficult it is for newcomers to come into the line in question. Now, a steel industry can't be carried on. You can't produce steel rails without very elaborate equipment. It's the technology of our time. It makes a steel company characteristically very large. And under those circumstances, no matter how talented you and I may be, we can't get into the steel industry because unless we have millions of dollars in order to do it. So the private ownership isn't the important thing, but the size and the expense of the tools are. The larger the size and the more expensive, the more tendency monopoly has to creep into the concern. And there you connect on with Dr. Hockey's observation about big business, I think an invalid one, earlier in this program.
And that is exactly what I hoped you would say, Dr. Walsh, because if it is a dangerous thing to have expensive tools, then the danger becomes even greater If government owned those tools, and if you please, you decrease the danger, make it less, if you provide for public ownership, for individual or private ownership of those tools. No one man has to own them all. The ownership is divided through the corporate structure. One can buy $50 worth of stock, $10 worth of stock, $1 worth of stock, and own some of those tools. And in one company alone, there are more stockholders than there are employees. That doesn't mean danger of monopoly.
Well, of course, that doesn't make for competition either. I mean, that doesn't make for a newcomer, obviously, doesn't it? It just means that more people own the stock of a given concern. And now, I don't mind Dr. Hockey's exploiting his well-known prejudice against government intervention, but I'm not arguing for government ownership. Government ownership, in the last analysis, may have to be employed in order to do away with monopoly in certain fields that are fighting, that's freezing free enterprise. But there are many things short of that are possible, such as price control, profit control, imposing quotas upon people. For example, your own, the company that you're identified with, Dr. Hockey, General Motors, there's a good deal of suspicion around among their own executives that they're going to produce at very marked a fraction of their capacity. Now, are they going to run at 95%, 85%, 75%, 65%? That question is of momentous importance to the United States, and it's of great importance to employment in this country, and it is a question which the company itself can decide, and that is the sign, again, of monopoly.
You're getting away from the question again there. Again, the alternative is private ownership of the tools or public ownership of the tools. And the point I make is that the private ownership of the tools tends away from monopoly. The public ownership of the tools...
Not if it gets into
tools,
the hands of a very few,
regardless, even if it's a few.
By on your own definition.
If it is a better situation than if it falls in the hands of government.
I don't...
Is the pure monopoly.
As I say,
and
you have...
And the alternative is private ownership.
A well-known prejudice on that, which is...
It isn't
all right.
You can call it a prejudice if you like.
But if you have a situation where it gets into the hands of a very few... What are you going to do on behalf of free enterprise, to which you presumably are very devoted? What are you going to do about it?
I'm going to do exactly what I'm doing now.
What are you doing
Be
now?
Be grateful that there is such tremendous competition in that industry, with the result that a car that was worth $5,000 20 or 30 years ago was not as good a car as a car that I can buy today for $1,000. Whereas in the field that you seem to favor, in home building, a $5,000 house in 1910 was not as good a house as a $3,000 house today, if you could build one for $3,000.
Well, again, may I ask
there
the question?
Very effective monopoly in that field.
I didn't ask that question. I said, what are you going to do when in
very
any field...
Very effective competition, I beg your pardon.
When in any field, the production gets in the hands of so few sellers that you have a monopolistic situation. What are you going to do?
Then I'm going to regulate it by law,
and
the law provides by that.
By government.
Precisely so.
Well, that's
all
I'm saying.
It is the function of government to see to it that there is fair and true competition. It is not the function of government to run the machine. And long before we get to the point that you fear, the public itself would have taken care of the situation.
Well, then, Mr. Ames, Dr. Hockey and I are agreed in regard to government ownership. I'd like to make that clear. Although I conceive that there may be situations wherein it will be perilously necessary for a society to impose government ownership where nothing else works. But short of that, there are many things, and they all are things that have to be done by government. And there I find Mr. Hockey in a strange quandary, because he is, in general terms, against government, and yet he is obliged to use government, by his own recent admission, to deal with those cases where monopoly actually exists.
Your statement, Dr. Walsh, about government brings us naturally to our final question. We haven't a great deal of time, but I think we have time for a brief comment on this question, Dr. Walsh. Do you consider patents to be monopolistic in the undesirable sense of the word?
Well, of course, a patent is a monopoly by definition. It gives the holder sole rights to exploit it, but we felt that it was wise to reward an inventor in that way and protect him for a while, and it wouldn't have any harm to the public, actually do it good by encouraging invention. But now, the patent has developed into a kind of a racket. Patents are almost self-continuing. You get out a minor improvement on the thing that you've patented 17 years before, and the lawyers get the thing fixed up, a patent on it, and you have a manufacturing process caught in a network of legal barbed wire, and the whole thing goes on endlessly, sort of perpetually. I ran across the other day the comment of a president of a large titanium concern Namely, that the whole purpose of the monopoly, of his concern, is to obtain a monopoly of patents so that they don't have to manufacture titanium. Others can't, except members, and they can raise prices and so on.
Well, that is
the use of the patent so frequently today that it's a matter of monopolistic
concern. Dr. Harkey.
It's rather interesting, Dr. Walsh, that whatever may or may not be the desires of someone, standing in the way of that monopoly is the antitrust law, which does not stand in the way of the one monopoly that I happen to fear. I don't think it's quite fair to say that patents copyrights automatically become monopolies, any more fair than this to say that I am against government. I'm going to come back to that for a moment. I am for government, strongly for government, a democratic government that encourages people to work, to save, to invest their money in tools, to produce more and more and more. The evils in monopolies and patents can be taken care of by regulation, and I think it would be extremely unhappy to destroy either of them in the purpose of doing away with the evils that may grow out of them. In that case, the remedy is worse than the disease.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, to interrupt your instructive and helpful discussion, but the clock tells me our time is up. Thank you, Dr. Walsh and you, Dr. Hockey, on behalf of the American Economic Foundation and more than 100 independent radio stations that carry Wake Up America from coast to coast. Next week, radio's original quiz debate will bring you another timely discussion of general interest. The topic will be, does the right to strike infringe the right to work? The speakers will be Dr. Henry Pratt Fairchild, chairman of the Department of Sociology, Graduate School of Arts and Sciences, New York University, and Mr. J.P. Seiberling, president of the Seiberling Rubber Company. Be with us next week at the same time to hear this important discussion. Now, here's Don Gardner.
You have been listening to the 311th Wake Up America Quiz Debate featuring Dr. Alfred P. Hockey, industrial consultant, economist, and lecturer, and Dr. J. Raymond Walsh, economist, lecturer, and radio commentator. Your comments are invited. A reprint of this program may be secured by sending 10 cents in coin or stamps to Wake Up America, 295 Madison Avenue, New York City, 17. Kindly specify program number 311 when placing your order. This is Don Gardner inviting you to be with us next week at the same time. Wake Up America is presented as a public service from Radio City in New York.